Now, I'll just note for the record, by the way, this first matter is the matter of the civil commitment of Mark Stephen Wallace, A20-0495. And so if both counsel are ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Tone, T-H-O-N. I am the attorney for appellant Mr. Mark Wallace. This appeal follows the trial court's commitment of Mr. Wallace as a sexually dangerous person or sexual psychopathic personality, SDP-SPP. The court, in committing Mr. Wallace, relied primarily upon Dr. Gilbertson's opinion. The court certainly has the discretion to do that, but in this case, there are numerous contradictions within the findings of fact and conclusions of law that I believe amount to clear error in this case. The first point I wanted to mention comes from the submissions to the court upon the conclusion of trial. So the court had the parties submit proposed findings. And when I reviewed the trial court's order, the court actually adopted a lot of the findings from the proposed order that I submitted, with one important difference. So in the proposed findings that I submitted, I did not argue that Dr. Gilbertson was the most persuasive doctor. And what the trial court did was adopt the body or the substance of many of my proposed findings and just change the ultimate conclusion. So for example, in finding 236C as in cat, this is a finding that I primarily listed a number of reasons why Dr. Gilbertson's opinion was not persuasive or credible. And at the end of it, the court simply changed the Dr. Gilbertson is not persuasive to Dr. Gilbertson is persuasive. And so what we're left with is a finding that argues all of the reasons why Dr. Gilbertson is actually persuasive, but then we have the opposite conclusion saying that he is. The next finding is very similar to that. That is a finding that I submitted where Dr. Pascucci thoughtfully considered a number of issues, and I'm essentially crediting her analysis. In my proposed order, I find that she is persuasive. Again, the trial court adopted the body, but changed the conclusion to find that she is not credible or persuasive. And so I think that those types of things that are throughout this order do amount to clear error. It just doesn't make sense when you say that Dr. Gilbertson is equivocal. He admitted all these things that are problematic with his opinion, yet you find him to be persuasive.
Ms. Tone, I'm kind of struggling on that issue because it seems to me that, I mean, oftentimes the parties will even stipulate to what the findings of fact are, or may say that the findings of fact are not in dispute. And ultimately, what is really important is the interpretation. No, maybe not interpretation, but the conclusion that results from how the district court evaluates, for example, the expert's testimony. And we give great deferences to the credibility determinations that a district court makes, particularly with respect to expert testimony. So why would that be clear error as long as the district court's conclusions of law are actually supported by the record?
And I don't think they are in this case. And I think a good example comes from the court's findings and conclusion as it relates to the static 99R and Dr. Gilbertson's opinion. So Dr. Gilbertson, in his report, he scored the static 99R, and he initially says that the appropriate score is either 5 or 6. And whether it's 5 or 6 depends upon whether or not you consider this kidnapping offense to be sexually motivated. So in his initial testimony and report, the score is 5 if the offense is not sexually motivated, 6 if it is sexually motivated. As we go through his testimony, Dr. Gilbertson was asked a question, if you do not find the kidnapping to be sexually motivated, is the score or should the score actually be a 3? He responds affirmatively. So then we have testimony that says, so initially he says, if it's not sexually motivated, the score is 5. And then he testifies that if it's not sexually motivated, the score is 3. As we're going through his direct examination, he's asked question about a different item within that tool.
Can I stop you right there? Now, can an expert change their opinion from the time that they actually wrote their written opinion to the time that they actually testify?
Absolutely. I think they just need to be able to explain why they changed it.
Okay, but ultimately, didn't Dr. Gelwitson say, testify, I should say, that the kidnapping was sexually motivated? Therefore, I gave him a static 99 score of 6 or 7, I think it was right around there, right?
Correct. Yep. So he ultimately landed on a 7. But I think the problem in this particular case is that we have district court findings essentially relying on Dr. Gelwitson and saying that, he was ambiguous in whether or not we have that 236C specifically says Dr. Gelwitson was equivocal talking about the issue of whether or not this offense is sexually motivated.
Right. That was in his initial report, but his testimony, he was not equivocal. His testimony was fairly clear.
I would disagree. I think he made a number of concessions in his testimony that admits this issue is ambiguous. And I think he, in fact, said that during testimony. And that's what the district court specifically found in that finding of fact 236C, that it is an ambiguous issue. That's why he provided the alternate scoring method. And so we do have him saying this is an ambiguous issue, and the court specifically finding that. And then, I think,
Ms. Dawn, I'm getting back, following up Judge Reyes' comment, you made the point about submitting the proposed findings, and as I look at the examples you make, it does look like those are largely undisputed in terms, it recites what he said, or what she said in terms of Dr. Pascucci. My question, though, ultimately, what is the error when we agree that ultimately credibility is the judge's sole discretion? We give deference to that.
I think the error is that the body of the finding doesn't support that conclusion. So if you're finding that this doctor is equivocal, this doctor is ambiguous, their conclusion, the doctor's conclusion is undercut by the rest of their opinion and other statements and testimony that they provide, that doesn't support that ultimate conclusion. So yes, the district court can make that credibility determination, but it also has to be reasoned and based on logic and the record. And so if one doctor is thoughtfully, carefully giving a reasoned explanation and you find them to be not credible, and another doctor is equivocal, ambiguous, and you find them to be credible, I think that's an example of clear error. It doesn't make sense why one doctor who's reasoned is not credible and why one doctor who's equivocal is credible. Judge Ross, I can't hear you.
There we go. I thought you could read lips. I guess I overestimated your capacity. Sorry about that. I haven't gone back and tried to do a comparison word for word between the findings that you propose and the findings adopted by the court. Are you suggesting in paragraph C of finding 236 that the judge changed only the word not, remove the word not from the court does find Dr. Gelwitson's opinion persuasive, that your proposed findings had said the court does not find Dr. Gelwitson's opinion persuasive?
I believe that to be correct. I can't say for 100%. I didn't just again review it right before coming on here, but I believe that the majority of that opinion, if not all of it, with the exception of that last sentence, is what I submitted in my proposed order about the reasons why he's not persuasive.
So you're suggesting that the district court took the word not out of your concluding sentence, but left everything else intact?
That's my understanding, my recollection of the record.
So, Ms. Tone, I'm looking at the district court's finding of fact 236, which is on page AA33 and 34 of the addendum. And the district court states that in his report, Dr. Gelwitson provided two different scores, parentheses 5 or 6, for respondent. During his direct testimony, he stated that he believed 6 was the most valid score, but subsequently changed his score to a 7. Dr. Pascucci gave respondent a score of 3. Dr. Thompson gave respondent a score of 6. So in that finding, the district court doesn't say in that particular those sentences there that Dr. Gelwitson was equivocal per se. He does acknowledge that he believed 6 was the most valid score, but then changed to 7. So there's a little bit of changing his opinion slightly, but even given that, still acknowledges that Dr. Thompson gave respondents a score of 6. So it seems like there's evidence in the record to support the district court's conclusions of law there.
But I think when you look at all of the findings contradict themselves on that particular issue about what score is correct, what score isn't correct within Dr. Gilbertson's own opinion. And I think there's the other findings that I would draw the court's attention to is the court talks about the importance of inter-rater reliability. So if two different doctors score the same subject on the same tool, we should have reliable scores. And I believe there's a specific finding that says the score should be within 1 point. So here you have the court landing on the most credible persuasive score is Dr. Gilbertson's score of 7. No other evaluator gave a score of 7. If inter-rater reliability is actually important, then we need an explanation from the trial court about why that score of 7 is more persuasive than all of the other scores.
Even given that, though, why do we need that if Dr. Thompson gave a score of 6? A score of 7 is within 1 point of that 6 score. And it actually seems more logical to accept the score of 6 or 7 versus accepting a score of 3, because I think you would need an explanation as to why the 3 score would be accepted, given that analysis and that logic.
There was a lot of evidence offered about why a score of 3 was the more reasoned and logical opinion. 3 evaluators provided a score of 3. And I do agree with respondents' argument in their brief. This is not a numbers game. It's not a majority rules. But I think at the end of the day, given the fact that we have all these discrepant findings, we have to have some kind of clear explanation from the court as to why this one score is the most relevant, most persuasive, and how that's different from the other ones. I just don't think that we got there in this case.
Well, but to your point about looking at, I mean, ultimately, the district court needs to look at a number of different factors here and not just the static score, because even the static score has its limitations, because you're looking at potentially immutable characteristics. So this is only one score, and the district court did look at a number of different factors and a number of different tests from a number of different examiners. So ultimately, looking at the big picture, we can try to poke holes in what the district court may have said here or there, but isn't the district court's ultimate conclusion based on the record evidence?
I don't believe it is, because when you look at those other tools and the bigger picture, again, it's strife with contradiction and inconsistency. So Dr. Gilbertson testified a comprehensive risk assessment includes the evaluation of static, protective, dynamic risk factors. He did not review dynamic risk factors. He did not review protective factors. He had a little chart that the court referenced in a finding within his report. He said every evaluation comes out the same. That's not true. When you look, we have the discrepancy in the static 99R scores. We have the something called the LSI. It's something the Department of Correction uses. Dr. Gilbertson's numbers within his report were mistaken. The most recent scoring on that tool showed a moderate risk, not a high risk, as indicated in his report. Dr. Gilbertson scored the VREG. In his testimony, he specifically said, that tool looks at violent, not sexual recidivism, which is what we're concerned about here. I don't really give this tool any weight. And the court made a specific finding to that. And then we go to the Linehan factors. The court, again, adopting many of my proposed findings, said the Linehan factors are outdated. The law is behind the science. The tools overlap with the Linehan factors. And then the district court went ahead, reviewed the Linehan factors, concluded that they indicate high risk. And so then you have this combination of the court saying, Linehan factors say high risk. They overlap with the tools. I give the static 99R a pretty good deal of weight. But then there's no commentary or explanation about how the court reconciles those two things so it doesn't run afoul with Spicer and Ince and that factor repetition. And so I think when you put all of those things together, it just amounts to clear error. And you can't piecemeal the conclusion from the findings. The findings do not add up to sufficiently support the conclusions. You don't have that meaningful connection that's required by the Spicer case. And I think that gets to the picture. So I'm just about out of time if the court has any last questions.
You'll have opportunity, of course, in rebuttal as well, Ms. Tan. Thank you. And Ms. Jones, on behalf of respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. Lisa Jones, J-O-N-E-S, appearing on behalf of respondent, Assistant Anoka County Attorney. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. The numerous offenses that Mr. Wallace committed against numerous victims do support the findings that the court made. There was no error on behalf of the court. Having heard what Ms. Tone argued, Ms. Tone is an excellent litigator and an excellent writer. The fact that the court used her wording but changed the conclusion doesn't make the findings or the conclusions of the court any less valid or based on, well,
if there's a dissertation of the facts which suggests a lack of credibility for one expert and a credibility for the other's viewpoint, a listing of facts that lead to a conclusion of a lack of reliance, and the district court changes the word, the conclusion, by deleting the word not, how is that logically consistent? Doesn't the district court have to be, usually conclusion flows from an analysis. And if the analysis leads to in one direction and the district court reaches a different conclusion, doesn't that call for our concern about either abuse of discretion or clear error?
I think when you read the findings in their entirety, the conclusions that are drawn are based on the evidence.
Okay, well, let's look at the paragraph 236, for example.
Sure.
Ms. Tome has suggested that the district court has left intact all of her reasoning, factual statements that would lead to the conclusion that she proposed, which was that the expert was not credible, not reliable. And the court, she says, changed the proposed finding by deleting the word not. First of all, do you agree with her characterization of what the district court did in that paragraph?
Honestly,
Yes, honestly.
Honestly, I can't say that I read Ms. Tone's proposed findings before I, as a preparation for oral argument. I have no reason to dispute what she's saying.
Let's assume she's accurate.
Sure.
How is that consistent with our deference to the district court's findings? Usually we defer to district court findings because we anticipate the district court has undertaken some reasoned analysis. But if the analysis leads to one conclusion and the district court simply adopts the findings of one party and changes the outcome without any change in the analysis, why would we trust the district court's analysis? On what basis would we trust the analysis?
I think that the paragraph is laying out what the evidence was. And there, look, the pivotal question is whether or not the kidnapping offense from 2015 and 16 was sexually motivated. And there was a vast difference of opinion on the experts, but on the experts only. As the court points out in their findings, the court received compelling testimony from that particular victim, that she was brutally, frequently, physically, and sexually abused on a daily basis. And so the fact that Dr. Gilbertson, before hearing that testimony, wrote a report and wasn't sure what to think of it is what is the finding. The report did differ from how he testified, and how he testified was that it was sexually motivated, and having heard that testimony was important, not only for Dr. Gilbertson, but for the court to make that finding and ascertain the credibility, which is what we're looking at here to determine, was that 2015-2016 kidnapping sexually motivated? No question.
Ms. Jones, could I want to follow up with that as it relates to Judge Ross's question. And under that subparagraph D, which is also part of two finding 236D, referenced on A appendix page 35. And so I'm presuming also, as we are by this discussion, that since you have no basis to dispute it, that Ms. Tan submitted this proposed finding. Dr. Pastucci, about halfway through that paragraph, explained that if the sex trafficking investigation had not occurred, she would have considered the kidnapping to be sexually motivated. And then she goes on to say, given his diagnostic profile, she views respondent as an antisocial violent offender who used sexual violence as a tool, not as primary motivation. So in other words, no one's disputing that she gave an explanation for why her opinion was it was not sexually motivated. And the last sentence, the court says, does not find Dr. Pastucci's opinion persuasive. I'm assuming there, the flip side, the court simply entered the word not. Do you see a distinction, again, on this theme that we're talking about, of a judge who explains why an expert, notwithstanding that careful analysis, finds that not persuasive? And perhaps it could have been some facts in the record that contests her basis. But would you see that that is at least a missing analysis by the court, which when we combine it with the previous paragraph where the word not is taken out, might lead us to be somewhat concerned about an abuse of discretion?
Well, when you look at just one paragraph at a time, I understand what the court is pointing out, but if you look at the very next paragraph, 237, it talks about Dr. Pascucci's score of 3. And the court finds that her score, the use, and the explanation was less persuasive. And what we're getting at here, again, is that index offense, whether you find that kidnapping was sexually motivated or not. And the court received testimony about the coding manual from the Static 99 and how this particular type of offense is in the coding manual considered sexually motivated. Dr. Pascucci was questioned about that. She adamantly stuck to her opinion that it was not sexually motivated, despite the overwhelming evidence that it was. Also, there is a rebuttable presumption that kidnapping, an offense of kidnapping, is harmful sexual conduct. When you look at 253D, the definition of harmful sexual conduct, she just blatantly ignores these things. I mean, the court did not find her to be as persuasive. The court also made other findings as to why she would be less persuasive. She did not follow Call versus Gomez. She didn't follow the 253D analysis of a lesser restrictive alternative in this case. But again, it does hinge on this kidnapping. And when you combine the evidence in the exhibits along with the testimony, it was clear that kidnapping was sexually motivated.
Ms. Jones, I'd like to follow up on the same question again and the same point, because I think it is important. I think both of you have identified whether the kidnapping is being credited as being sexually motivated is one of the key issues, not the only one, but certainly an important one. And if the district court oftentimes will adopt proposed findings of fact, either because they're well written, which may be the case here, but oftentimes the district court will adopt findings of fact because they're written in a way that is favorable to one party or the other. And looking, let's assume for the sake of argument that the district court did adopt Ms. Tone's proposed findings of fact. It could either be because they were just very well written, which they, if they are They certainly are very well written, or because the district court may have actually agreed with the kind of persuasive way that they're written. When I look at, for example, 236C, you talked about Dr. Gilbertson's testimony versus his opinion, but when I read that paragraph, it starts out by saying that his opinion was equivocal as to whether or not the kidnapping was sexually motivated. But then the rest of the paragraph talks about his testimony, what he was asked about, and it ends concluding by saying, with a second last paragraph sentence, I'm sorry, Dr. Gilbertson testified that he included two different static 99R scores in his report. And this is his testimony, not his report. He testified he included them because there is some ambiguity as to whether the kidnapping is sexually motivated and can be counted as the index offense. The court does find Dr. Gilbertson's opinion persuasive, but his opinion is there's some ambiguity. So how can that be persuasive? It seems like a non sequitur. It doesn't seem to follow from that.
So leave the line of questioning when you talk about testimony and his scoring, the ambiguity would have been before he heard AS testify. So he was explaining his report in that testimony. Dr. Gilbertson was asked on cross-examination, is this sexually motivated? And he answered, it was not equivocal. It was certain, yes, this was sexually motivated. He was asked, well, why wouldn't she have come forward? And he explained that as well, indicating he believed that she was showing a Stockholm syndrome where she has sympathy for her captor. So he was clear when he testified. So the overall findings that the court made does support the conclusion of the district court, and there is no error. The decision is well founded or well based in the exhibits and the testimony that the court received. Mr. Wallace does meet the definition of a sexually dangerous person, as well as the definition of a sexual psychopathic personality. Appellant argued in their brief that the district court kind of flip-flopped the analysis needed to satisfy sexual psychopathic personality. Perhaps the finding that they point out was maybe not worded the best, the court did follow it up with saying the higher standard of commitment as SPP was met, showing that the court understood that the sexual psychopathic personality standard is higher than the sexually dangerous person. When we look at not only the statute, but case law for sexual psychopathic personality, Mr. Wallace clearly meets the criteria. He does have this pattern of offending, which the Blodgett court talks about satisfying the utter lack of control, his nature and frequency of the assaults. The nature of his assaults don't change. He binds his victims with ligatures. He blindfolds them. He covers their eyes and he brutally assaults them. The degree of violence that he uses is another factor from Blodgett. He is a highly violent man. And even Dr. Pascucci agreed with that. He uses threats of the fact that he literally got away with murder as a way of showing that he has this utter lack of control. And finally, the Irwin factors, or the Irwin decision, talks about the lack of insight, indicates the inability to control their impulses. And Mr. Wallace shows he has a lack of insight. He blames his victim. He does not walk away from his using of methamphetamine, which is kind of a precursor for him sexually assaulting So I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision, which is based on the record below, and there were no errors.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. And Ms. Tan, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you. You know, a lot of what I just heard goes back to what I call the ick factor, which has been talked about in some cases before. Mr. Wallace has an icky history. He is a violent man. That really wasn't disputed or contested in court. His history is ugly. But at the end of the day, this is about sexually dangerous person, sexual psychopathic. Just because the person is a domestic abuser, which was largely Dr. Pascucci's testimony, doesn't mean they qualify for the SDP-SPP commitment. Likewise, we cannot punish him for things that he has not been criminally sanctioned for. And a lot of that commentary within the SPP case law factors, I think, really goes to that ick factor. You know, and again, when we go back to this clear error issue, in the SPP case law factors specifically, that is finding 268. The court specifically finds that there's an overlap within the SPP case law factors, that they repeat themselves, and then the court, for some reason, determines that it's going to give that a lot of weight. We don't know why. Again, that's expressly contradictory to the INS caution against factor repetition.
Well, Ms. Stone, I mean, even the Supreme Court has acknowledged that there are a number of different tests that are out there and a number of different cases that say you consider the Lenihan factors, you consider the INSE factors, you consider the Blodgett factors. There's a lot that's being thrown out at discourse in terms of look at this, look at it, but also look at this. Oh, and by the way, this is a non-exclusive list. And you need to look at anything that else that might be relevant, but make sure you don't double count things and watch out for things that overlap. I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's the case law and the guidance for district courts, I'm not sure is the as clear cut as anybody would like. And I think the district court's acknowledgement of that is commendable, that there's a little bit of tension here, and there appears to be some overlap with respect to the factors. But ultimately, when you look at what the district court did, it seems like the district court took a very, very concerted approach of all the different tests that are out there, of all the different factors, of the testimony of the experts, what they said, not only in their opinions, but what they said during the trial itself, and made a reasoned decision. And we give great deference to the, in particular, finds credible and what doesn't. So while there may be some areas where it could have been clarified a little bit more, the record seems to support the district court's decision. So I understand that there are parts that may not add up as neatly as we would like. But overall, does that amount to an abuse of discretion by the district court?
I think in this case it does, and I completely agree. The district court does not have an easy job. These things are complicated. I've argued repeatedly before the Court of Appeals that the case law fact, there are just too many things to be considered, and that should all go away, and we should have a new system. You know, we should, and I argue that unsuccessfully, unfortunately, but I will continue to argue that for all of the reasons you just stated. But I think at the end of the day, it doesn't change the end result. And in this case, because the court is picking and choosing proposed orders and using the substance of, or excuse me, not proposed orders, proposed findings and conclusions, the underlying analysis and the logic for those does not match the conclusion. And I hate to use the word schizophrenic, but it jumps around in a way that I don't think is logical and reasoned and is not consistent with the record in this case. Because all of these things lead one to conclude this examiner is credible, reliable, persuasive, what have you. But then reaching that ultimate conclusion that they're not, and vice versa on the other end, I don't think 2 and 2 add up to 4 in this case. That's what I believe is required by Ince and Spicer, no matter how difficult it is. And so I do think that we reach the standard necessary here for the court to find abuse of discretion clear. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing. It is somewhat voluminous for all the reasons that we were just talking about as well. And so we will take the matter under advisement, of course, issue a ruling in the statutory time period. So thank you both, and you both have